You're listening to Faith and Family. I'm Andy Bates. We like to share stories here on Faith and Family that encourage you to get out and serve in your community. And we have a great story today to share with you that tells you about some folks who have done just that. They saw a need in their community and stepped up to the opportunity to serve and meet those needs. Thanks to our underwriter, Concordia University, Wisconsin, for supporting Faith and Family. You can find out more about them on our website, kfuo.org. Look for the CUW logo there. Joining me by phone today, Kevin Jamison. He's the CEO and co-founder of Veterans Community Project. Kevin, welcome to Faith and Family.
Oh, thank you. Thanks for having me.
Glad to have you as our guest today on Faith and Family, and looking forward to learning more about the Veterans Community Project. Before we get too deep into what it is and what the Veterans Community Project does, can you give us just a little idea, a foretaste of what is Veterans Community Project, and then we'll talk a little bit about the history, how it started, and why you got involved as well.
Sure. Most people don't know about Veterans Community Project because they've never heard the name, but if we say we're the group that are building tiny houses for homeless veterans in Kansas City, that's how people recognize us. We came up as an organization. We were working with homeless veterans in various capacities, and we got tired of watching veterans fall through the cracks and not receive the services they needed to recover from homelessness. And we decided that we were going to do something about it in our community. And so we came up with the name Veterans Community Project because we wanted to bring veterans together to attack a veteran problem. And we also wanted to be an avenue for the community to give back to veterans. And we wanted to be a community of veterans helping. And just the name, that's how we came about.
Tell me about your career in the Armed Forces.
I served 20 years in the Marine Corps, three tours in Iraq. I was in Haiti in 94, and then part of a rescue mission in Albania in 97.
Before we get to your return, what led up to you wanting to serve in this way, serving with the Marines?
I have one of my Marines that was from my first tour in Iraq that called me when I was about to graduate from college a couple of years ago. And after I retired, I wanted to start my life over and get a degree. So I went back to school, and my Marine called me, and he was struggling. He was going through some issues, and I stayed on the phone with him for a while. And when I hung up the phone, it was a very life-changing conversation. I decided that that's what I wanted to do. It just gave me a sense of purpose that I wanted to be there to help other veterans that couldn't help themselves or advocate or born as recovered from combat, you know, the trauma associated with combat PTSD as I had. And I wanted to help them down that road to recovery. So that's when I applied for a job at a homeless shelter and got it.
So this was all from one fellow veteran that you learned about. What did you see? What did you learn about the needs of other veterans in your community?
When I started work at the home shelter, I was doing street outreach for a homeless veteran program called SSVF. And what I was discovering was that veterans, first of all, I was a veteran, so I was very successful at speaking with them and working with them. But I was discovering that the veterans were, they weren't advocating for themselves. Some of them had been told no for so long that they weren't even asking for help anymore. They felt shunned by the system, by society. A lot of them had just given up, and it was heartbreaking. You know, I watched veterans that could get help not get it. I watched veterans that not qualify for programs, and that's basically why we started, was I was saying no to more veterans than I was helping through a program because of the restrictions associated with the grant money. It was a VA grant, and those restrictions prevented me from serving a certain class of veterans. Either they didn't have enough active duty time, or they didn't deploy long enough. You know, Missouri National Guard that doesn't deploy, they don't qualify for VA services unless it's it meets certain conditions. And it was heartbreaking to watch some of these people that were out there suffer on the streets, and that's, you know, being you know, in combat and losing, watching people die on a battlefield, you know, I wasn't about to let any of my brothers and sisters die on the streets of my hometown.
So you worked at a homeless shelter. You saw this need in your community. What was it that really sparked the launch of Veterans Community Project?
Sure. Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's real simple. It was Memorial Day of 2015. It was that weekend, and it was Friday. We had been working with a veteran, and basically, long story short, is he ended up getting thrown out of his apartment. His stuff was put in the lawn and it being rained on, and his service animal had been picked up by animal control. And Chris, the co-founder, one of the co-founders, and I, we were at a barbecue at his house that weekend, and we decided enough was enough, that we had just seen too many vets suffer, and this was a family that was put out on the streets, and you know, they basically had nowhere to go. And Chris put the family up in a hotel over the weekend until we could get them in a shelter, and we decided enough was enough. We wanted to be a place, a refuge of that was combating homelessness on both ends, not just trying to solve it by providing tiny homes that, you know, restored dignity, but also we're attacking the front end as well, preventing veterans from hitting the streets.
So tell me about the tiny house village, this veterans village that you've established. How does it work? How does the program work?
Well, we're not housing veterans yet because when we bought the land, there was no sewer on the land. So we expect to have the sewer installed and be housing veterans by July or August. How the program works is really simple. We seek corporate sponsors or private sponsors for a home. They donate the money to build the home. We build it. We build it using ourselves. We partner with local trade unions and local businesses and volunteers to build the homes. We even have homeless veterans that come out and help us build. And then after the homes are built, what we do is we're always out on the streets talking to the veterans on the streets, outreaching them, making sure that their needs are met currently and that they're safe. And what we also do is we measure, and we use a tool that is common in social services called the ISPADAT. And we measure their vulnerability to homelessness. And the higher they score on that scale, the higher their priority to receive a home. And what our goal is after the houses are built, we're going to build 10 houses and then house 10 veterans at a time. And the goal is to walk out on the street, hand them a key, and remove all obstacles between them and their own home. And we're identifying the veterans. There's no application process because we fear if there is an application process, then what happens is we're going to have people applying to live there that are already in a house or apartment that might think our home is nicer or something like that. And our homes are transitional housing. The veteran can stay there, we say, as long as they need to recover, but we're hoping to keep most stays under 18 months. But the veteran can stay there as long as they need to, and we're going to stay by their side. And we're not attacking homelessness specifically. We're already beating that by providing them a home. What we're attacking are the symptoms and causes of homelessness. We're attacking the addiction, the mental health issues, the employment issue, the legal issues. We're attacking all the issues surrounding that person, whatever they may be. And we're providing a village which provides social support and structure for the veterans to support each other in the recovery from homelessness.
So it's not just a housing, but housing with these comprehensive services that, yeah, that really address what leads to homelessness.
Yeah. What I tell people is when I'm speaking to different groups is that, you know, most veteran programs that house veterans end when they house a veteran. And that's why a couple of veterans that I worked with were housed by different organizations, and I went to see them in their house, and they had no furniture, no food, no utensils to cook or eat with. And because they housed a veteran, they considered it a success. Well, our program begins with housing, and our success is watching that veteran transition from the streets to to their own permanent house with a permanent solution, with items they stay, with their dignity restored, with employment, or income, with, you know, self-respect, and then a sense of community. And also, I think one of the keys that we're going to be bringing to them by building this community is providing social support. And for the veteran has a place to go always.
When, let's go back to when you first returned home.
Uh-huh.
What was it like adjusting to life here in the States after all the ways that you had served and all that you had seen in your service?
For me, the adjustment when returning from a tour of duty is difficult. Your family's learned to function without you. There's just so many things that have changed, and you're coming back, and you want things to go back to right to the way they were, but everything's changed, and it's an adjustment period. And if you don't have the social support, you don't have the family, you don't have the friends that can help you guide you through that in a healthy manner, the stresses of combat, they don't leave your side when you leave combat. And sometimes some people handle that better than others, and it can be a struggle. And there's a lot of social stigmas associated with PTSD that, and unfortunately sometimes it's got bad connotations when, it's something that can be battled and you can beat it. And it just takes a lot of work and a lot of help and a lot of people being there, and it takes a community. And, that's, transition from combat. The transition from the military to the civilian world was, for me, I had been in the military for 20 years. It was significant. I lost my identity. I went from wearing a uniform, having rank one day to the next day it's done. And there was no smooth transition out. It was just done, and it was very shocking. It was very humbling. It was devastating, and you have to learn how to function. Luckily, I had family around me. I had friends. I had employment, and I had friends where I worked at, and that had gone through the same transition. So I had a good support network, and a lot of veterans don't have that. And we want to be there for them. Those guys, the young guys transitioning back in the community, we're hoping that they reach out to us at Veterans Community Project, and we can begin helping them transition back in the community. It's huge.
Those who don't have that network of support, do they often find themselves in isolation?
It can lead to that. Every person's struggle is unique, and how they, some people are equipped to overcome it and some people aren't, and it can very easily lead to that. But it's a case by case basis. But, if you look at the statistics for homelessness, and you look at the veteran population, there's a significant, significant portion of the homeless population that are veterans, and there's a reason for it. And we are trying to attack it in our community.
So what are the ways then that you see this Veterans Community Project doing that? We've talked about housing, but also these comprehensive services that will help help them through some of the challenges that veterans face that lead to homelessness.
We do that through advocacy and awareness. If you look at our Facebook page, we mention a lot of issues that concern veterans. We address them, and we make the community aware of those issues. Sometimes we meet veterans with unique needs, and we'll post it up there. But the way you attack it is as a community, and that's our goal. Is we want to leverage the community to support these problems, to support a veteran's recovery from these problems. It's quite people often ask, how are you doing this? How are you doing this? And I'm like, I work every day, and I walk into buildings and businesses, and I ask, say, here's the problem. How would you like to help us? And I have yet to have anyone tell me no or say that they don't want to help or can't help. So our philosophy is we basically, Veterans Village is kind of like our Field of Dreams. We are building it, and the community is coming to us and helping us. So we're not hiring psychologists. We're asking psychologists that live in Kansas City, can you come and give an hour to a vet a week? And they're stepping up and coming. We have, you know, we have doctors who want to provide free examinations. We have people that want to come and garden with the veterans. We have people that want to come teach cooking classes to the veterans. We have people that want to teach sewing classes to the veterans. We have people that want to host reading time to the veterans. We have yoga instructors reached out and want to teach PTSD yoga to our veterans. It's been so humbling to see the community response just because we asked.
Hmm. Let's go back to the tiny house village, the village that you're
sure.
building that will welcome and provide housing for these veterans.
Sure.
What is what will be inside each of these tiny houses? And for our listeners not familiar with tiny houses, well, let's start with that. What is a tiny house? What defines a tiny house?
The exact definition, I think it's under 600 square feet. I'm not sure, so please don't quote me on that. I'm definitely not an expert on tiny houses. But our tiny houses, our tiny houses are 240 square feet. They're one story. They're very basic because not in what they do, but they're very basic in amenities. So we have, you know, we have a bed. Our houses are insulated. They're built to the same standards that new homes in Kansas City are being built to. So we're held to the newer building codes. We have to pull permits and build these houses just like a contractor that builds a regular house would. They have a full bathroom with a sink. We could put a tub in some. Most of them have a shower, a stand-up shower in it. And then we have a toilet. And then they have a refrigerator, a kitchen sink, an oven. And granted, they're a little small refrigerator, not a tiny one, but a medium-sized refrigerator. An oven. They have a cabinet with the houses will be full of pots, pans, dishes, and everything that the veteran wants or will need. They'll have a computer with free internet. They're going to have a free TV that they come in and it's all theirs. And when they move out, they can take anything in that house with them. Basically, they have everything that they would have in their own apartment except for a laundry facility, which will have a group laundry facility.
How then, walk me through this process that helps mm-hmm. helps them transition. So they move from homelessness, living on the streets or wherever they may be, to living in this veterans village with
right.
these nice amenities, to what's the next step? How are they prepared to move on to that next step of living a sustainable, independent life?
It takes a lot of work. And not just by the veterans. Well, first of all, we're not forcing anyone to live in the village. We're offering them a key. And, you know, if you want to come in, come in. And then we're going to let them stay there for the first 2 weeks. We're not even going to do anything more than observe and talk and get to know them. And what we want them to understand is we're not treating them like clients. They're not clients. We're their partners. We're their partners in their recovery from homelessness. Not only that, but we're going to be their social support. We're going to be their friends. We're going to be there for them. And we're going to stand beside them. And it all starts, the first step is getting them into the village. Once they come in, it's been establishing trust with them. We don't want to force things on them. We don't want them to feel like they're in an institution. We want them to feel at home. We want them to relax. We want them to get out of the survival mode that they've been in on the street. And then what we're going to do is everything starts with paperwork. mm-hmm. So we take care of the birth certificate and the identification because you can't get a job unless you have that. You can't get a house unless you have all of your paperwork done. And we start with paperwork and we move forward and we assess all the areas they need help in. We've got business leaders in the community and people that work at banks that want to do one-on-one financial counseling with the veterans the whole way through their stay and teach them about finances and financial management and help them. We can start employing them right away if they want to work because we're starting a business building tiny houses that employs homeless veterans. And we've already got one house on order right now, so it's kind of fun. But they can start working right away and start having income. And restoring dignity, restoring respect, and more importantly, is being there with them the whole way and understanding that they're human beings and they're gonna make mistakes. If they have an addiction, we have to understand that recovery is gonna take a long time, and we have to be there for them. If they have mental health issues, we have to understand and have compassion for these people that it's going to take a little while to get the meds right. And we just need to be there for them and work with them through that. So our clinical director will be observing the veteran and creating what we call a recovery plan, treatment plan. And then we'll be having people that are working with the veteran one-on-one to help get them through that. And it's a slow process, and we're going to move at the veteran's pace. That's the bottom line. You know, we're going to push them along, but we're also not going to force them to where they want to cut and run and leave. We want to be there and work at their pace. We want to create a safe place for them to stay. And basically, in my experiences, you just start working and you just be there for the veteran, and you earn their trust. And then you work with them, and it will be successful. And we're hoping that the group living together, we're creating, because we're building 10 houses, a housing 10 at a time, we're hoping we create a group of mentors that when the next 10 veterans come in, these guys can help guide them through the recovery. Now they got somebody that's a little further down the road than they are, helping them get to that position they're at.
Why are volunteers essential to this program?
Volunteers are essential for several reasons, but the main reason why volunteers are essential is because it shows the veteran that the community cares. And volunteers are people that are willing to give their time. They're not being forced to do it. They're not getting paid to do it. These are people that are doing it because it's genuine and it's out of their hearts. And the veterans have, you know, we've had volunteer events where we had homeless vets working beside other veterans that volunteered. And it was really cool because nobody called them a homeless veteran. You know, they felt normal. They were treated like everyone else, and everybody talked to them and hung out with them. And it was just a beautiful thing. And that's what we want. We want that stigma, that word homeless, we want it gone. You know, we just want them to be viewed as veterans that serve their country.
So volunteers who are compassionate and understanding are certainly essential to this. Are there other things that are key to the success of this program?
For us, the keys to our success really in the initial stages have been the local business community, and I can't say it enough, is city government support has been outstanding. We wouldn't have gotten the land without city government support. We would not have pushed our plans through city council and been rezoned and permitted to build without their support. The city government support has been huge. They were willing to change, you know, we build under what's called a cottage code. So our homes have to be a minimum of 220 square feet, and ours are 240. So without the city council, we never would have been as far as we were. The mayor support, the local government support has been one of the keys to our success. That's how we got our plans approved within city limits.
Now, this is all taking place in the greater Kansas City area, correct?
Yes, it is.
How can those who are listening step up to volunteer if they're in the Kansas City area and find out more?
Oh, yeah. If you're in the Kansas City area, you can go to veteranscommunityproject.org and you can sign up to volunteer, or you can message us on Facebook at our Facebook page, which is just Veterans Community Project. You do a search, you'll find it. We get a lot of inquiries from people that are wondering how to do this in their city. And my first suggestion to everyone that wants to do this in their city is get involved with the people providing services to the homeless in your city right now. Volunteer. Become aware of the problem. Become familiar with the problem. Understand the need in your community, and then decide how you want to attack it. We were working within the problem, and you know, we didn't feel it needed this. We felt compelled to do this. We felt you know, we had to do this. There was just no choice for us. You know, just saying no and watching families and people, human beings suffer, and it just did not sit well with us. And I think that it starts with understanding the needs of the homeless in your community and understanding the reasons. You know, not every community is the same with their homeless population and how that they're handled, how the system handles them, how the system treats them, how the law enforcement interacts with the homeless. It's different in every community. And I try to tell people, you know, understand your community needs and your community problems is always the first step.
Kevin Jamison, COO and co-founder of Veterans Community Project Kansas City. Kevin, thanks so much for being my guest today and sharing your story with us.
Oh, thank you for having me.
Concordia University, Wisconsin, in Mequon overlooks a half mile of beautiful Lake Michigan shoreline. CUW campus is located 15 miles north of Milwaukee, with over 70 undergraduate majors, 28 graduate degree programs, and doctorate programs in pharmacy, physical therapy, occupational therapy, and nursing practice. CUW offers online learning and accelerated learning at one of 9 Wisconsin centers and one in St. Louis. Traditional or accelerated education, CUW has the program for you. CUW.edu.
This is Life Issues with Brad Mattis, president of Life Issues Institute.
What a difference a year makes. Last year, the March for Life in Washington, D.C. was small because of the blizzard. Barack Obama was in the White House blocking all pro-life legislation. This year, the crowd was huge, and President Trump tweeted, "You have my full support." At the star-studded march, Vice President Pence declared, "Life is winning in America because of all of you." Baltimore Ravens NFL tight end Benjamin Watson said, "We as men must stand up for the lives of the innocent and their mothers in crisis." Kellyanne Conway, counselor to the president, rejoiced, "It's a new day and a new dawn for life in America." God's blessed us with great opportunity this year if we are willing to put in the effort. Please commit to praying for the babies.
Like us on Facebook at Life Issues and stay informed, more informed than you've ever been.
Did you know that Moments of Assurance is celebrating its 10th anniversary? To help celebrate, we're offering you a chance to win dinner for two, music, and chocolates, a $175 value. You'll get a $100 gift card for dinner at a restaurant of your choice, plus two Lilyfield CDs and a very nice, delicious box of chocolates. That's dinner, music, and chocolates, compliments of worldwide KFUOP listening Thursday, February 9th, for your chance to win.
Welcome back to Faith and Family. I'm Andy Bates. Recently, you might have heard the American Academy of Pediatrics released a statement saying basically that abortion is a right of adolescents, that adolescents have a right to abortion. We're going to talk about that today. Something that I think is very important to understand, though, as we approach this topic. Who is the American Academy of Pediatrics, and are there other organizations? You know that many times here we have guests from the American College of Pediatricians. Is there a difference between the organizations? Joining us today by phone, Dr. Michelle Critella. She is the president of the American College of Pediatricians. Dr. Critella, welcome back to Faith and Family.
Hi, good morning, Andy. Thanks. It's great to be here.
Always a pleasure to have you as our guest. And how are things going with the American College of Pediatricians these days?
The American College of Pediatricians is doing very well. We are so pleased with all the pro-life appointments, nominations, and certainly with the President Trump reinstating the Mexico City policy where we will not be funding abortions internationally. So we are thrilled with those developments.
I had the privilege also of talking with one of the college members at the March for Life this year as well. Dr. Gambosi joined us by phone to share his perspective, and since then he shared with me a little bit more of his perspective in retrospect after visiting the March for Life, and I hope to talk with him again in the future and hear more about his involvement with the March for Life. This was a fairly new thing for him, and hope to continue to hear more from the American College of Pediatricians about events like that, the March for Life. Recently, the American Academy of Pediatrics, a different organization, released a statement regarding adolescence and abortion. Before we get into their statement, help us understand, who are these two organizations, the American College of Pediatricians, the organization of which you're president, and the American Academy of Pediatrics?
The American Academy of Pediatrics is about 80 years old. Initially, when they were founded, they actually were, their motto still says they are for all children. And initially they were pro-life, and they saw their, they were pro-life, they were pro-parental rights. However, following Roe v. Wade, they flip-flopped. They no longer viewed the unborn child as their patient, and they came out in full support of abortion rights for teenage women. They also came out in support of confidential care to teenage patients, particularly in the areas of sex, drugs, alcohol, and mental illness, meaning they encourage pediatricians to interview children from the ages of that 11, 12-year-old visit separately from the parents, and when it comes to issues such as dispensing birth control, helping them secure abortions, that they could go ahead and provide that care to the children confidentially without involving the parents. The American College of Pediatricians was formed in 2002 by AAP, or Academy, members. many of us had been trying within the Academy to bring back the pro-life and the pro-parent and the pro-family pillars. But we reached a point in 2002 when the American Academy of Pediatrics came out against the science, but fully embracing political correctness, and they were actually supporting gay parenting, saying that same-sex parenting does not pose any risk to children and is as nurturing as the traditional natural family. And that's when the pediatricians, a core group of us pediatricians, got together and said, you know what, we can't, our voices are not being heard. We're not able to even present to the American people that there are many pediatricians who disagree with this organization. So we broke apart and formed our own. So that's how the American College of Pediatricians was born. We don't disagree with everything the Academy comes out with. They do have a tremendous number of scientific resources on a whole multitude of issues, but on these social science issues that involve moral life principles, we have a strong disagreement. We believe they misrepresent the science.
The recent statement from the Academy, the American Academy of Pediatrics, just looking at the abstract, it's a statement that reaffirms its position that the rights of adolescents to confidential care when considering abortion should be protected. Also, that includes the parental involvement and consent, their views on that. As you mentioned earlier, this is... Would you say this is rooted in a science or a political agenda?
You have to look at, if we stick with the science, number one, the Academy is being hypocritical in that every abortion is anti-child. They're sanctioning the killing of their preborn patient. So that's hypocrisy. Number two, the Academy has correctly come out and identified that teenage patients are cognitively not adults. They are not capable of weighing risks and benefits and thinking of the future in the way that adults can. And the Academy has come out in other position statements saying how crucial it is to have mothers and fathers assist their teenagers and be involved in their lives. But on this particular issue of abortion, all of a sudden, that's not important anymore. And we should be quite comfortable treating 14-year-old girls as though they are adults. So, again, that's politics. The other problem that we in the college have is that, look, parents are the ones responsible for the well-being of their children, not doctors, not judges, okay, but the parents. So when these teen girls go and have their abortions without parental knowledge, it's the parents who are at home. So when these girls come home and they have excessive bleeding, they have infection, they go into a massive depression or anxiety attacks, the parents are the ones confronted with these quote-unquote side effects of abortion. Well, the parents have a right to know. The parents had a right to know before their child had the abortion. And many pediatricians, myself included, can attest to the fact that a teen girl will come in, find out she's pregnant, be like, oh, my gosh, my mom will kill me. My dad will kill me. Well, believe it or not, when a caring, compassionate pediatrician is there, I and my colleagues have never had a child murdered before our eyes. When there is a pediatrician there to facilitate the communication between a pregnant adolescent and a parent to help them see and understand they are not alone, there are resources, we can help you with this. Again, just because the adolescent reacts with, oh my God, they're going to kill me, does not mean that they're in an abusive family.
It sounds like to me that one of the clearly dividing issues on this is who is, as you pointed out, who is responsible for that minor, for that adolescent who is a minor? Is it, who is responsible for that person? Is it the parents? Is it the state?
Right.
Is it the physician? It's the parents, clearly, but obviously statements like this from the American Academy and other organizations seem to believe that either that child is autonomous or it is the responsibility of the state.
Of the state, yeah. And it's interesting because they will, they fall back on, well, there are abusive families. There are parents who abuse their children. We must protect the children from these situations. To which I say, okay, explain to me how helping a girl get an abortion is helping her out of her abusive family situation. The answer is it doesn't. So it's the straw man. When you have a pregnant teenager and you can confirm that, oh my gosh, she's in a dangerous situation, the answer is not to kill her baby. The answer is to take care of the teenage girl and her baby. Get the social services in place and so forth. Abortion, just like in the case of rape and incest, very easily turns into a way to benefit the abuser. It just helps things get swept under the carpet.
How does the college respond to statements like this? What is the college's practice or procedure for responding to statements like this?
We have a number of we have our own position statements on our website, and in general, we've detailed much of what I've already spoken of here in this segment, just detailing both the neurocognitive development of the teenagers, detailing what's involved in the abortion procedures, what the risks are. Basically, our response is just to repeat the scientific facts that the other side is glossing over.
The website, bestforchildren.org, B-E-S-T, the number 4children.org. That's the American College of Pediatricians. Our guest today, Dr. Michelle Critella, president of the American College of Pediatricians. Dr. Critella, thank you for being our guest today.
Oh, thank you so much for having us on.
Up in just a moment, we'll talk with the Ohio Right to Life and their response to the statement from the American Academy as well. You're listening to Faith and Family on Worldwide KFUO.
This is Pastor Mark Azil, the LCMS Director of Campus Ministry and the Chancellor of LCMSU, inviting you to join us right here on Wednesdays at 2 p.m. in the Student Union. If you can't make it, Student Union is always available as a podcast at kfuo.org. Learn more about LCMSU at lcmsu.org. And remember, college is tough. You need Jesus. We'll help.
Wednesday afternoon at 2 on KFUO.
Most of my family, they never graduated high school, so I'm trying to break that barrier.
My daughter, Brooklyn, was also a motivation for me to go back to school.
Every day after work, went straight to school, and it paid off.
At age 26, Kareem finished his high school diploma.
I could not have done it alone. I see the future is really bright for me.
No one gets a diploma alone. If you're thinking of finishing your high school diploma, you have help. Find free adult education classes near you at finishyourdiploma.org. Brought to you by the Dollar General Literacy Foundation and the Ad Council.
I'm Gary Duncan, the General Manager of Worldwide KFUO. We promote our various programs. We ask you to listen to your favorite show. We ask you to support our broadcast ministry, and we thank you for that support. But maybe we don't ask you to pray for us as much as we should. Please pray for the staff, management, radio hosts, and volunteers here at Worldwide KFUO. Pray that the message of salvation through Christ is heard clearly by listeners around the world. Pray that we continue to reach into those areas that are hostile to the Word of God. Pray that KFUO continues to reach those people desperately needing to hear the good news message. And pray that God continues to bless us financially through the gifts we need to continue our broadcast ministry. Thank you for listening, supporting, and praying for Worldwide KFUO. You truly are appreciated. We are the messenger of good news, AM 850 in St. Louis, worldwide at kfuo.org.
You're listening to Faith and Family. I'm Andy Bates. Recently, the American Academy of Pediatrics released a statement on the on adolescents and abortion, standing in favor of abortion for adolescents, saying that it is a right for them. And having just talked with the American College of Pediatricians, now we go to the Ohio Right to Life, Katie Franklin, Director of Communications there. Katie, welcome to Faith and Family.
Thank you so much for having me.
My pleasure. Thanks for being my guest today. Tell me a little bit about the work of Ohio Right to Life. What is the main work of Ohio Right to Life?
Well, Ohio Right to Life is the state's largest and longest-serving pro-life advocacy organization, and we do a ton of education just trying to spread the word of, you know, human development and the value of human life across our state, but we also work on legislation very heavily in our state, and we've been very fortunate to see abortions decrease here in the state of Ohio over the last 5 years by 25%. So, you know, that's not all attributed to Ohio Right to Life. There are many other pro-life organizations mm-hmm. in our state who are doing the good work, but That's just kind of a glimpse of, you know, who we are and what we do.
25% is significant.
It is.
Indeed.
It is. That's thousands of lives.
Wow.
7,000.
Certainly something to be thankful for.
Certainly.
What have been some of the significant issues that Ohio Right to Life has addressed in this past year?
Well, most significantly, just in December, we had the Governor John Kasich sign our Pain Capable Unborn Child Protection Act, which is part of a national strategy to prohibit abortions when babies can feel pain. We know that babies have pain receptors present throughout their entire bodies by 20 weeks gestation. So this legislation prohibits abortions right there at the 20-week mark. And I think that it's a really great educational piece, too, because it really humanizes the experience of the unborn child. And it tells women and it tells fathers about, you know, what that baby is going through at the moment they're, you know, being very brutally aborted. So we just saw that legislation signed in December. And that's the pretty big one that Ohio has just gotten here, and we're going to keep working on other legislative initiatives. You know, there's still over 20,000 abortions that occur in Ohio every year, and while we're making a difference, we have to keep working on that.
The American Academy of Pediatrics recently released a statement regarding abortion in adolescents, claiming basically that abortion is a right of adolescents, as well as privacy, that the parental consent is not needed. As a matter of fact, that adolescents would be encouraged to include their parents in the decision, but they do not support the requirement of parents being included in that decision. What is the response of Ohio Right to Life regarding this American Academy of Pediatrics statement?
Well, Ohio Right to Life, when we saw this, a pediatrician who's a very good supporter of ours brought it to our attention, and we were immediately just taken aback. This has been a longstanding policy for the American Academy of Pediatrics, but this was just an affirmation of what they've already been saying. But it really kind of shocks the conscience, because over 70% of Americans support parental consent laws. It's just common sense that even pro-choice people would want to see some parental involvement. Abortion is a very impactful, huge decision that doesn't just take the life of an unborn child, but impacts a woman psychologically for the rest of her life. So we were, you know, very taken aback by the fact that an organization that says it's dedicated to the health of all children is in fact harming children twice with this statement. So at Ohio Right to Life, we decided, you know what, we should do something about this, and we decided to go ahead and work with a number of other medical associations, including the American College of Pediatricians and some bioethical centers across the United States that definitely oppose this kind of position statement. And we asked, we're urging the American Academy of Pediatrics to rescind this statement.
You mentioned that, I believe that was a statement from the president of Ohio Right to Life. And a sad twist, yes. The Academy, in fact, harms children twice.
Correct.
Can you elaborate on that?
Yeah, so as I said, this kind of a statement harms children twice. First, the adolescent, you know, this whole statement talks about this child, this adolescent, this teenager who's still going through the highs and lows of, you know, just the development that you're going through as a young person, and who isn't necessarily in the best place to make this kind of life-altering and life-ending decision. So it really turns things on its head by removing parents from the equation, and allowing this young, still developing child to make a decision that ends the life of another child. It truly undermines the value of both of those children and their lives, and what, you know, what that young girl is going to face and suffer with for the rest of her life.
What baffles me regarding this position is, even aside from moral issues, religious issues, supporting, as a pediatrician, supporting abortion, it just, it does not make sense to me in any way as a pediatrician, because that's, even from a selfish perspective, that's a potential patient. Client, customer. It makes absolutely, even from a selfish perspective, it still makes no sense to me.
Right. That's why I think it's, you know, when we read this statement, we thought, well, this is clearly politics first. This is ideology first. It's not common sense. It just doesn't resonate with the average American who, you know, just doesn't think that a child should be left with this weighty decision all on their own. It just, it's not rational. And you're right, pediatricians, they should have an interest in protecting every human life. And medically, they're more intimately aware of all of the intricate details of human development than everyone else is. So I would think that there's still more of a burden on these pediatricians to just honestly recognize what they're saying.
For the pediatricians still in who are a part of the academy who perhaps disagree with this statement, there is an option for them. There's the American College of Pediatricians that truly supports all life, and there's an option for them if they're looking for a group of colleagues to support them. Speaking of groups and voices, who are the associations and voices that have joined you in responding to this statement from the Academy?
Yeah, well, as you said, the American College of Pediatricians, as well as the Christian Medical and Dental Associations, and then some bioethical centers. The National Catholic Bioethics Center is one, the Center for Bioethics at Cedarville University here in Ohio, and the American Association of Pro-Life OBGYNs, which is another really great resource, as well as the Catholic Medical Association. So I think we had about six of these other medical associations join us.
And that's no insignificant voice when these organizations, especially of medical professionals and those who are researching these issues as well, that's no insignificant voice. Thank you for your work and for what you're doing in responding to this statement from the Academy. And where do we go from here?
Well, from here, I think that it's, you know, incumbent on all pro-life people to speak up and stand up and be counted on this. And if you're a pediatrician, if you're a doctor, to really hold these medical associations accountable for putting politics above medicine, above science. And then, of course, you know, I think that it's always a powerful thing to pray for a change in hearts and minds on this subject.
Our guest today, Katie Franklin, Director of Communications, Ohio Right to Life. Katie, thank you so much for being my guest today and sharing with us your response to the Academy's statement.
Thank you, Andy.
Coming up in just a little bit, Thy Strong Word. Tomorrow on Faith and Family, I'm going to take a look at some results, the results of the youth poll at the 2016 LCMS National Youth Gathering. What did youth have to say? How did they respond to the questions in the poll? And what does that say about our youth? And perhaps what that means for the future? We'll talk with the Director of Youth Ministry for the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod, as well as others, as we look over those results. Thy Strong Word up next on Worldwide KFUO.
Listen to Faith and Family Monday through Friday at this time. Faith and Family is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is needed for Faith and Family to continue. Our address is 1333 South Kirkwood Road, St. Louis, Missouri, 63122. You can contact us on the web and download Faith and Family at KFUO.org. Worldwide KFUO, on the air, online, and on demand.